Fight the Empire with Per Fagering, and attendance to the Heather McCoy Show. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Aisha Papacha Butok, author of the Trojan War Museum and other stories. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed will share their favorite reads. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. If you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagering. This time we're going to talk about World War II and Russia. Last Sunday was the 80th anniversary of the German invasion of Poland. And to a lot of people, they saw this as the start of World War II. But it really wasn't. The real World War II really began much sooner than that. You could say that it was a continuation of World War I, which in itself was a result of the European nations dividing up Africa about 30 years before that. When you look at at World War I, it involved 10 imperial nations were involved in that war: the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, Holland, Italy, Austria, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. And they all had overseas empires, probably except for Russia. Its empire kind of extended into Asia. But so you had all these imperial nations scrapping it out in an insane war. And near the end of that war, Russia had a little revolution, and they pulled out. So this really greatly angered the Allies, because Russia was fighting Germany on that Eastern Front. And so the U.S. and Britain and France and Italy and Japan all invaded Russia from one area or another. And the Russian invasion or the Civil War actually went on for a couple of years. A lot of people were killed. It was a very violent little war. And it poisoned relations between the West and Russia for the rest of the century. So after World War I, you know, we had there was a kind of a fake prosperity in the 20s. In 1929, the capitalist economies all collapsed, while apparently, according to the figures that were presented in this article, Russia's economy was growing. This information is taken from an article in Common Dreams website by Robert Freeman. Really worth reading. So in 1929, the capitalist economies collapsed, and the capitalists saw growing Russian revolutionary fervor growing in Germany. There were a couple attempted revolutions. They didn't succeed, but the capitalists turned to Adolf Hitler as a fighter against Bolshevism. And he actually became a Chancellor of Germany in 1933. Well, right away, Hitler began amassing power. In October in that year, Germany quit the League of Nations and began rearming, because one of the results of World War I was that Germany had to promise not to rearm, and they also had a lot of war debt put on them. But so Hitler quit the League of Nations and began rearming, and the West really didn't do very much. They just kind of sat back and let it happen. In 1935, Britain signed a naval agreement with Germany, and ending a lot of the limitations on rearming. In 1936, Hitler invaded the Rhineland. This is that border region with France, which had been given to France after World War I. So Hitler invaded, and Britain kind of sat back and let that happen. France was in really not much of a position to do anything about it. So basically, Britain kind of sat back and deserted France. This is kind of a turning point, that this invasion of the Rhineland really boosted Hitler at home in Germany with his voters. And it turned out that as he told his own generals, that if France had resisted, that Germany would have retreated. They would have given up this invasion. But France is in no position to resist without British help, which is not forthcoming. So it's once again that Britain kind of allowed Hitler to pump up his power. Then in 1936 was the Spanish Civil War, where the U.S. and Britain remained neutral. The Spanish Civil War was a revolt of the military against an elected, kind of mildly leftist government, the Spanish Republic. They were voted into power, and generals, not at that time, they were not led by Francisco Franco. He kind of assumed power later. But the so the U.S. and Britain, they stayed neutral. They refused to supply arms to the Spanish Republic. But Germany and Italy backed the fascists. And in fact, the German warplanes did a little practice bombing in Spain. That's what the Picasso's painting Guernica was all about. So here in the Spanish Civil War, the U.S. and Britain once again allowed Hitler to kind of boost his power. Then in 1938, Germany annexed Austria. Britain backed down, and British Prime Minister Chamberlain made some remark. He could understand why German-speaking people would want to be reunited. Remember that Austria was a German-speaking nation, and this annexation, they were called the Anschluss, sort of united these two countries. So once again, Hitler boosted his power, and Britain backed down and let it happen. Also in that year, Hitler demanded part of Czechoslovakia. Russia had offered to help fight this move by Germany, but Britain turned down Russian help. The ostensible issue was an area in Czechoslovakia known as a Sudetenland, which was populated by a lot of German-speaking people, but somehow the way borders changed, they wound up being in Czechoslovakia, which was a nation that had been created after World War I. But Chamberlain kind of went along with that. He was quoted as saying, Herr Hitler has made up his mind to attack Czechoslovakia and then proceed further east. Well, further east means in the direction of Russia. So we begin to see what might have been the underlying strategy behind this these goings on, that that the Allies, Britain and the U.S., were kind of boosting Hitler and encouraging him to fight the Bolshevik menace. Later on, when Germany took over Slovakia, Chamberlain said that, well, there's no point in going to war over a country, Slovakia, that no longer exists. Lord Halifax, the British foreign minister, said that, he was not the British foreign minister, he was just a high mucky-muck in England. He called Germany, quote, a bulwark of the West against Bolshevism. And Neville Henderson, who was a foreign minister, said, quote, the German is certainly more civilized than the Slav. So you can see all these moves going on where Hitler was boosted in Germany and encouraged to fight against the Russians. Well, the Russians were really getting kind of panicked by this time. And but then in 1939, Hitler was planning to invade Russia, but then he offered a non-aggression pact with the Russians. Now, non-aggression is not an alliance. It just means that these two countries are not going to fight each other. Well, Stalin agreed to that because he needed to buy time. And Hitler was thinking that if he sidelined Russia, if he kept Russia from going to war against him, he could fight on the Western Front against France and the other European allies. So that was Hitler's strategy. But for a lot of people, you know, growing up learning history here at home, the Munich Agreement was considered appeasement, that somehow Chamberlain was appeasing Hitler, you know, for the sake of peace. Well, he was appeasing Hitler, but it wasn't for peace. It was to get Hitler pointed in the direction of Russia. But apparently Chamberlain miscalculated on Hitler. He was double-crossed in a way because Hitler decided to go to war against the West, against all their fondest dreams. Well, all this was in the Common Dreams article by Robert Freeman. Meanwhile, Poland was kind of caught in the middle, being between they were the nation between Russia and Germany. So any attack in either direction would have to go through Poland. If Germany was to attack Russia, they would have to go through Poland. If Russia was to attack Nazi Germany, they would have to go through Poland. Well, throughout history, the Russian-Polish border was all over the map. In fact, it brings to mind a joke from the last century where a kid comes running up to his grandma and says, "Grandma, Grandma, they changed the borders. We're now part of Poland." And the old lady says, "Oh, thank God. I don't think I could stand another Russian winter." But anyway, the Polish elites, they had ideas of glory themselves. At one time, a few hundred years before, there was a Polish-Lithuanian empire that extended well into what's now Russia. And also during the Munich Agreement, Poland grabbed a piece of Czechoslovakia. Well, now let's turn to Germany while this is going on. Adolf Hitler was a World War I veteran. He was a company runner during the war. I believe he got wounded, got a medal. And after the war, he organized what they call the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923. He actually tried to seize power in Germany. Well, the Beer Hall Putsch was a flop, and Hitler was sentenced to, she was charged with treason, high treason, but he was sentenced to 5 years in Landsberg prison, which is kind of a castle prison where he actually had pretty nice quarters all to himself, and he was hardly treated like a traitor. He had decent quarters. I believe he could wear civilian clothes. And while he was in prison, he dictated his famous book, Mein Kampf, to Rudolf Hess. And he was sentenced to 5 years for treason, but he's released after only 9 months. So he's back in civilian life again. Well, apparently Hitler learned his lesson, but the lesson he learned was that armed revolution was not the way to proceed to power in Germany, that you might be able to find a legal path to power, sort of acquiescing to, with the help of the upper class, the moguls, the industrialists. Well, after he got out of prison, Hitler didn't do that well, but his party was kind of growing. They fought a lot of street battles with the communists. And in a way, the street battles, they were kind of a lot of, kind of like the street battles we have right now. You know, they were big news, they were violent, and upset a lot of people. And one thing that Hitler was doing with these street battles was proving himself as a resolute enemy of the Bolsheviks. He's proving himself to the big boys. And then along came 1929 when the economy collapsed. By this time, Hitler and his Nazi party were pretty well financed. He was getting money from a woman, a upper class woman named Helena Beckstein, who was the wife of a guy whose factory turned out pianos. And more importantly, he was getting support from the steel barons, Fritz Thyssen and Gustav Krupp. So Hitler was getting a lot of high-level support. And what this shows is that fascism didn't bubble up from below. A lot of people think of it that way, as kind of something that comes up from the lower depths and engulfs society. No, fascism in Germany was it was really put over on the Germans by people like Hitler, fanatics, and Nazis, with a lot of help from the industrialists and the aristocracy. What the street fights did was they kind of alarmed ordinary people who just saw the violence, didn't maybe realize all the machinations going on behind the scenes. They saw the violence, maybe hurt by the violence, so they just wanted the violence to end. And they sort of found that in Adolf Hitler. And so Hitler convinced the big shots that he could deal with the Reds. And so at home, he was doing, sort of making a unspoken deal with the with global capitalism, that he could deal with the Reds at home and abroad. So in a way, that was what World War II was all about. It was the Western powers had encouraged Hitler to go against the Russian revolutionaries, and he double-crossed them and went against the Western powers instead, although he did wind up on fighting on the Eastern Front too. In fact, it was the Red Army that defeated Nazi Germany. They took the brunt of the casualties. They fought the main battle against Hitler. The Western role, which sort of was mainly the invasion in Normandy, came rather late in the war. And so Hitler actually was defeated by, he was defeated by the Russians. Well, now the Russians then were Bolsheviks. They were revolutionaries, self-proclaimed revolutionaries. Although some people may think that, they weren't that revolutionary, really. Stalin kind of put the brakes on a lot of revolutions abroad. He sort of wanted to consolidate power in Soviet Russia, to pretty disastrous effects, by the way. And so, the communism has kind of come and gone in Russia. Russia is no longer communist, but it is still considered an enemy. And you really have to wonder why. And I think to that we might have to go back into history. You can go way back. There was a big split in the Roman Empire where the western half of the Roman Empire, centered in Italy, kind of fell to the so-called barbarians, where the eastern portion, centered around Constantinople, thrived for another 1,000 years. And the split in the empire, Roman Empire, kind of was followed by a split in religion, where Western Europe, Italy and France and parts of Germany became Roman Catholic, where the eastern portion became Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox. And so the West still had designs on Russia. After communism collapsed, Boris Yeltsin became the president of Russia. And his time in office was marked by horrible corruption, where that's the beginning of some of the oligarchs. These were people who managed to gain control of public assets in Soviet Russia, and they sold off these assets to the West for at bargain rates, where the West got the assets and the oligarchs got their split. And they were happy. The Russian people were not very happy, where standard of living went way down, health care went way down, the age, the age where people that people would live to went down, especially for men. Alcoholism went up. It was the Yeltsin years are really a disaster for Russia. And this went on for quite a while, for the decade of the 90s. In the middle of that, the U.S. Interfered in the Russian election by sending all kinds of money and advisors to Boris Yeltsin so that he could get reelected in, I believe it was 1996. He was reelected, and the looting went on until Yeltsin's health really declined. He was a pretty far gone alcoholic by this time, kind of an embarrassment, really. And so he kind of gave up, he turned over the government to an unknown former intelligence person named Vladimir Putin. Nobody really knew who Putin was. They sort of assumed that he was a person they could do business with. Well, it turned out that he had different ideas. And one thing he did do, he kind of put a stop to some of this wholesale robbery that was going on in Russia. You might say there's no more looting under Vladimir Putin. But he put a stop to that. Some of the oligarchs made a deal with him. He didn't have power to take away their money, but I guess he did have enough power to compel some of them to keep their wealth but at least pay taxes to the government, which some of them did. They stayed in Russia. Other oligarchs decided, heck with that. They left Russia. They took up residence in a lot of them took up residence in London. It became a sort of center for Russian oligarchs. And so that's kind of where we are right now. We after a whole century of war with Russia, we are still have this sort of feeling that Russia is the enemy, which actually, if you heard the program, Sojourner Truth interview with Danny Sheehan, I mean, as far as he was concerned, Russia is still the enemy. And you have to wonder why. They're not a, they are a kind of a democracy. They do have elections that do matter. They do have a lot of shortcomings. They do have a press. Some of the newspapers in Russia are very much anti-Putin. So you can criticize Russia under Putin, but they can certainly, a lot of things can be improved there. But I think one thing is pretty clear, that you're not going to help Russia by moving troops right up to the border, which is what the West has been doing. They have troops right on the border of Russia, just a couple hundred miles from St. Petersburg and Moscow, with missiles right up there ready to go. And there was also the kind of the so-called revolution, the change of government in Ukraine, where an elected president was overthrown by street mobs. And under the direction, basically, of the West, you had an Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria, what's her name? She was out there passing out cookies and biscuits to the people in Kiev. And there was some overheard conversations between her and Victoria Nuland was her name, and she was discussing with the ambassador who would take power in Ukraine after President Yanukovych was driven out. And so they sort of settled on a fellow named Yastremsky, and who didn't last too long. Since then, they have had an election. They've had a couple elections in Ukraine. And you have a former comedian, TV comedian, who is in power now. And he looks like he's actually making a few moves towards kind of patching things up with Russia. But part of the, this is part of this grand move against Russia that's been going on for 100 years or so. Is continuing. The government, elected leader of Ukraine, was thrown out. Russia responded by one thing that Yanukovych, the guy who was kicked out, most of his support came from the people of eastern Ukraine who spoke Russian and kind of looked to Russia for their guidance. Ukraine, like other countries, had borders all over the place. And so that was the origin of the split. The Crimea was seized back by Russia. So there we are today. This is sort of a World War II, is a kind of an anti-Russian crusade. And so that's been Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for the Heather McCoy Show.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU. in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9:59. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather interviews Mark Stein about the Stonewall Riot. And at 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Aisha Papacha Buchak, author of Trojan War Museum and other stories. At 11:30, Black Book talks to Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed, who will share their favorite reads. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th at 1 p.m. at the PCC Cascade Campus in Portland.
The MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration features music, theater, food, drink, dancing, and raffle prizes. There's also a vendor fair for the kickoff celebration to the MLK Run on Sunday, September 8th.
Again, that's the MLK Dream Run Kickoff Celebration on Saturday, September 7th from 1 to 8 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, located at 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.